The Sunni insurgent group, the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq, better known as ISIS, has made major inroads into Iraq in recent weeks. It's been reported today that they may be within an hour's drive of Baghdad. ISIS's arrival isn't just a problem for Iraq's Shiite-led government. It also has major implications for Iraq's neighbors and the rest of the Middle East. Joining me now is Michael Crowley, Time Magazine's chief foreign correspondent. His article, The End of Iraq, appears on is the cover story of the June 30th issue of the magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hello. I'm very pleased to be here.
It's been suggested that Saudi Arabia is funding ISIS, which Saudi Arabia strongly denies. Do we know where the group is getting its money other than from the oil wells that it's captured?
Well, it comes from a variety of sources. I think that it's probably not accurate. It's not accurate to say the Saudis are directly funding ISIS. To the extent that ISIS is getting money from the oil-rich Sunni Gulf nations, that is primarily happening as a matter of private donations. There are many wealthy, sort of princes in these countries who may be millionaires who either want to kind of out of religious zeal or for sport or as a hobby, like to fund radical activity abroad, or in some cases they may be giving money to things that they think are charities, which are sort of religious, proselytizing, and the money doesn't go exactly where they think it does. But I have seen assessments from intelligence officials who say they don't even think that is the majority of ISIS's funding, certainly not at this point. ISIS has developed very sophisticated ways of bringing in revenue that are often likened to, essentially organized crime and racketeering, protection money, taxes on, commerce and trucking in areas they control. They also just, will essentially tax people. I've read that they are taxing Christians who can choose between crucifixion or paying taxes, and I think that's probably an unpleasant but easy choice. And finally, plunder and theft. There are reports that ISIS has plundered hundreds of millions of dollars from the cities they've captured in northern Iraq, and while some suggest those numbers are probably inflated, it's almost certainly in the many millions. So there is funding from these Gulf Arab states. I don't think it's really coming from the governments, but I'm not even sure that that is the majority relative to their other sort of criminal-esque activities.
Since ISIS's goal, one of its goals, is to create a caliphate, is that something that many people in the area would subscribe to?
Not so many. It's important to understand that what's happening in Iraq right now is often described as, sort of this invasion by ISIS, which is essentially a, kind of a terroristic army that that is sort of half the remnant of the Al-Qaeda-aligned forces that fought the Americans in Iraq when we occupied the country. And then also it has sort of morphed into being a fighting force against the regime in Syria. They have been on the march in northern Iraq, and what they would like to do is capture large amounts of territory and form a caliphate. But they are doing this with the help of Sunni tribesmen and other Sunnis in Iraq who are very unhappy with the Shiite-led government in Iraq, who are kind of using ISIS as the point of the spear to fight back against the government, to reclaim land, to essentially stage a rebellion. But that does not mean they share the ultimate goal that ISIS has of an Islamic caliphate ruled under, strict Sharia law, banning alcohol, all kinds of forms of entertainment, women not able to leave their homes without a male companion. So even many religiously conservative Sunnis in the region think that these ISIS guys are, to put it bluntly, a little crazy, but they are useful partners of convenience in the moment. The hope in the West is that that alliance won't endure and they will devolve into intra-Sunni squabbling as they did when the U.S. occupied Iraq, and ISIS will kind of lose its power.
Iraqi President Nouri al-Maliki has been criticized for heightening sectarian differences during his time in office, ousting Sunni politicians, targeting the Sunni community. Has he shown himself to be any more willing to make concessions to the Sunnis and the Kurds since ISIS's offensive began?
He has not. And, you know, the latest reporting out of Iraq suggests that even, fellow Shiites who in the past have been aligned with him and supportive of him are starting to wonder whether he has to go. His instinct here has not been to be conciliatory. It has been to say, this is a conspiracy. This is a coup. This is anti-democratic. It's the work of outsiders who are out to get the Iraqi Shiites. And if I give an inch, they're going to take a mile. He is not in a conciliatory mood. He may believe that with the help, particularly of Shiite Iran, which does not want to see the Sunnis gain strength, and certainly not ISIS, and with the United States, in a state of alarm and kind of looking for a quick solution, that he can hold out. But it's not clear whether that's going to be possible. He is getting pressure from Washington and now also, more importantly, from Shiite leaders within the country to say, you need to make some concessions or we have to find someone else. But that's easier said than done for a number of reasons, including it's not clear at all who would replace Maliki and whether that person would be in a position to make concessions.
It's been reported that he's also gotten support from Syria, which did a bombing raid. But you say he doesn't want to give an inch. He's already given miles. ISIS took the northern city of Mosul, which is Iraq's second largest city, on June 10th, even though there were 30,000 Iraqi troops who were defending the city. Was the Iraqi government caught by surprise? Was American intelligence not paying attention?
Well, I think that clearly the Iraqi government and U.S. intelligence underestimated how severe the problem was. But it's not the case that we and they were blindsided the way many sort of typical, even savvy American news consumers might have been, who woke up one day and said, holy smokes, a quarter of Iraq is essentially in the hands of ISIS. The U.S. officials say that they, could see this coming and that they were trying to talk to Maliki about responding effectively, maybe having more of an American role, and that didn't go anywhere. Maliki may have been in a bit of denial. He may also have underestimated the discontent within the Iraqi security forces. The reason that a much larger number of Iraqi security forces were defeated by and in many cases simply fled what may have been 1,000 ISIS fighters, or by some estimates a little less, is that they were Sunnis in Sunni areas where everyone, to simplify it, hates Maliki and didn't want to fight for him, and the local population was not on the side of the army. And a lot of these guys said, forget it. I'm not going to die for this guy in any way. Everyone in this area, hates the guys in Iraqi uniforms right now. They see us as an extension of Maliki's power, and they basically see Maliki as a Shiite Saddam. So I guess, Maliki can't have expected that outcome, or he would have realigned his forces in some way. But the drum has been beating on this front for a while. Much of Anbar province in the west, the city of Fallujah, fell to ISIS back in the winter, and that was really the clearest sign that ISIS was on the march and had territorial ambitions. So we were not totally blindsided.
I'm talking with Michael Crowley, Time Magazine's chief foreign correspondent, whose article, The End of Iraq, was the cover story for Time's June 30th issue. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How have Iraq's Kurds reacted to ISIS's arrival?
Well, the Kurds are a very interesting case. They have done pretty well since the fall of Saddam. They were very brutally oppressed by him for decades, and you know, since the fall of Saddam, they have, you know, the Kurdish region of northern Iraq has actually had strong economic growth.
And a lot of independence.
I mean, they essentially have, you know, already have a kind of semi-autonomous political structure, and they argue a lot with Baghdad about various issues, and are still part of the government. But there is quite a lot of autonomy. It feels like, you know, people who visit there regularly say it feels like a very different region, almost like its own place. So, you know, what the Kurds have done, among other things, is to grab some important territory that is basically surrendered by the Iraqi security forces. The most notable one is Kirkuk, which is an important northern city over which the Kurds and Baghdad have argued for years. Who controls Kirkuk? Who does Kirkuk belong to? Well, what happened was when ISIS came marching, the Iraqi security forces in Kirkuk said, "We're out of here." They essentially fled. ISIS took it. And the Kurds said, "Oh, well, that is kind of ripe for the taking right now. We can kick ISIS out. We're not afraid to fight them. We'll take Kirkuk." ISIS, they defeated ISIS, and the Iraqi security forces were in no position to hold them off. So it was a it was making an opportunity out of a crisis for the Kurds. Now, that said, nobody wants a radical Islamist caliphate on their border. And so I think the Kurds have some mixed feelings about what's happening here. ISIS is very dangerous. It's not, for now, ISIS is not fighting the Kurds. They've essentially let them have Kirkuk, but that's not guaranteed to last forever. And I think that the Kurds would be, you know, maybe happy with an outcome where ISIS is driven out and defeated, but, you know, there's a new reality on the ground that takes them one step closer to either full independence in their own state, or kind of a region in a much more federalized Iraq where power is devolved. The last thing I'll just say very quickly is U.S. officials argue it is not in the interest of the Kurds to be independent at this time.
And John Kerry talked to the leadership about that.
That's right. And, you know, a number that will kind of help explain why that would be is $10 billion. I'm told that the Kurds, although they can begin to export their own oil, oil from their own land, and get revenues from that, and that can be lucrative, they will still come out in the near term $10 billion ahead annually by sharing oil revenues with the central government under the system as it exists now. They don't like it. They think they should get more money. There are lots of things they don't like about having to deal with Baghdad. But what administration officials say is they are still better off financially being part of a unified Iraq where that oil revenue is shared, because there is so much oil in the Shiite South.
Hasn't Turkey gotten involved in all of this for a while? They were allowing their border to be rather porous and ISIS to move back and forth, and now they seem to be rather concerned. They've also opposed the formation of a Kurdish state for many years. Has that position changed in recent weeks as ISIS has made all these gains in Iraq and kind of threatened Turkey?
The Turkish position on Kurdish independence has changed, although it's been a long process. It's not something that has happened in a matter of weeks thanks to ISIS. This is an important development in that region. You know, to step back, again, the Kurds are a sort of much maligned and oppressed people who for a long time have wanted independence. They were drawn into these other countries, and their population was sort of divided up unhappily, and they have at various times pushed for independence, sometimes through violence, and been repressed pretty thoroughly. The Turks have always been very wary of Kurdish independence. There are a lot of Kurds in Turkey, and the Turks don't want to give up any of their territory, among other things. But in recent years, going back to the point that I made before, as the Turks have seen this semi-autonomous Kurdistan develop in post-Saddam Iraq, has seen economic opportunities there, has seen that this a Kurdish state could be a very useful trading partner, could provide them with a lot of oil, and could provide them with a nice kind of buffer of stability and security, between them and the chaos of the rest of Iraq. They seem to be warming to this idea. They seem to be willing to entertain at least Iraqi Kurdish moves towards independence. I don't think they're quite there yet, but you've gone from a situation where a few years ago Turkey was massing huge numbers of troops on its border prepared to fight with the Kurds if they tried to make a play for independence, to saying, well, you know, we can see some reasons why this might work for us, and we can see some reasons why this could be win-win. And so I think that's why, Kurdish independence is a much more plausible outcome than it was even just a few years ago.
The Shiites have firmer control of the southern part of Iraq. Is it likely that ISIS will try to challenge that, take over the whole country?
I think it's unlikely, and I think that U.S. officials also don't lose a lot of sleep over the idea that ISIS would march all the way through and conquer Iraq from top to bottom. You will notice that the ISIS offensive has essentially stalled out in the northern half of the country. They're in the north and in the west. They've not made it to Baghdad. That's because, again, to go back to what I was saying before, a relatively small ISIS force has cut through northern Iraq. To use the cliche, but it's descriptive, like a knife through warm butter. The restive, rebellious, aggrieved Sunni populations in those parts of the country were the warm butter that just made it very easy for ISIS to march through, chase off the security forces, and capture territory. When you start getting to the Shiite areas, it's a very different story. The Shiites absolutely despise ISIS. The feeling is quite mutual. Each group would be very happy to kill the other. And so when ISIS starts getting into hostile territory, it can't just move around however it likes. And so even getting to Baghdad, which is heavily Shiite, hasn't been possible so far. I think a thing to worry about, which I think the administration does worry about, is something that I just wrote about this morning on Time.com, if anyone cares to read it. It is the prospect of another sectarian civil war. So it's not that ISIS would march down all the way to Basra in the south. It's that ISIS would provoke sectarian furies and passions, and specifically the thing I wrote about is the threat to an ancient Shiite shrine in Samarra, which al-Qaeda in Iraq blew up in the year 2006, and many U.S. officials say that was really the start of the religious civil war that engulfed Iraq. So the concern would be some event that turns Sunni and Shia all over the country against one another, and you have a bloodbath, but not a march by ISIS all the way to the south.
Now, is ISIS an outgrowth of al-Qaeda in Iraq? It was connected to al-Qaeda in general until there was a big split. To some degree, it seems to be achieving what al-Qaeda said it wanted to achieve, which is creating an independent nation, a caliphate of sorts. Is that split going to be a big problem? One of the reasons that this whole area has such a shaky balance of power that you wrote about in your article?
Yeah, so the split is very interesting. I mean, the short answer is that ISIS is a kind of next generation of what we called al-Qaeda in Iraq. So when the U.S. occupied Iraq, there were, the old Saddam Baathists, the Sunni allies of Saddam's regime fighting us, Shiite militias, supported and encouraged by Iran, who just did. So the Baathists resented that we had kicked out Saddam. The Shiites just didn't like us being there, and they don't really like America, so they were fighting us. And then you had this kind of al-Qaeda-inspired terroristic group that was an important part of the insurgency, that was fomenting sectarian war. That was al-Qaeda in Iraq. That group is essentially merged into or morphed into ISIS, joined the fight in Syria, drew strength there, attracted fighters from around the world who were drawn to the jihad against the Assad regime. And so that is ISIS now. ISIS has essentially split from Al-Qaeda Central for a variety of reasons, much of it having to do with essentially, you know, kind of an ego and power struggle between the leaders of the two groups. Right now, what we call core Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was Osama bin Laden's deputy and successor, and the leader of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who is a probably, by many accounts, a more charismatic, more effective leader than Zawahiri, and who resents the rise of this new kind of hero of jihadists. Al-Qaeda, bin Laden's Al-Qaeda was somewhat more focused on what they described as the far enemy, which was to say striking the United States, among other reasons, to get us to withdraw from the Middle East so that they could topple governments and establish that caliphate. ISIS is more interested in the near enemy, which is the fight in the region against people like Bashar al-Assad and Nouri al-Maliki. The last thing I would just say is, so what does this mean? The good news is that in Syria, for instance, ISIS has been fighting the more directly Al-Qaeda-backed group in a kind of internecine fight among the Sunni radicals. And that is that, you know, the U.S. is pretty happy to see them kind of killing each other off. The bad news is that, you know, you essentially now have a second powerful group that would be happy to hit the U.S. And to some degree, you know, it may sound silly, but I think intelligence officials really believe these groups cooperate and would like to outdo one another. And ISIS may be more interested in the near enemy than Al-Qaeda was, but would love to strike a big blow against the U.S. just to show that they are big players for propaganda reasons, for recruitment reasons. So you could have a little bit of a competition now between these two groups to try to hit American and Western targets, which, of course, is very worrisome.
Michael, we have very little time left, but Iraq is in an odd place because it's bordered by some Shiite countries, some Sunni countries, and also by Lebanon, which has its own Shiite-Sunni struggle going on. Does all of this promise to destabilize the area a lot more?
It absolutely does. You know, you're already seeing this kind of Armageddon-like situation where, Iran has sent some military forces into Iraq and is flying drones and is advising the Iraqi security forces. It's prepared to send more forces, for instance, to defend some of these holy shrines, like the one that I referred to earlier. Hezbollah, which is Iran's essentially kind of proxy terrorist army, has said similar things, that they would join the fight if ISIS were to start rampaging, were to start striking holy sites. There has been violence in Lebanon associated with this. ISIS is up to the border of Jordan. We've seen airstrikes by the Syrian regime on ISIS fighters who are kind of going in and out of Iraq. It all kind of feels like borders are bleeding and what's happening is sectarian passions are rising. And that can really get out of control and can spread across borders in a way that would reap huge instability. And why does the average American care about this? Someone listening to this now might say, it's really hard to keep all this straight. It's such a mess. Can't we just kind of stay out of it? The answer is that the global economy still runs on oil, and for all the talk of fracking and natural gas and solar here in the United States, our economy is still hugely oil dependent, and oil markets are global, so it doesn't matter where we're importing it from. If Middle East oil gets more expensive and more scarce, prices rise for everyone, our gas prices rise, our electricity bills rise, the global economy slows down. That's really bad news. Number two, the terrorist threat that we talked about, if ISIS can create a large safe haven sanctuary, that makes it a lot easier for them to train and plan for terror attacks. And third, this is very, very worrisome for America's close ally, Israel, which is watching absolute chaos break out around its borders and could be greatly endangered by the rise of radicalism and sectarian passions in the region and radical groups competing to show how dangerous and how lethal they are.
Michael Crowley is Time Magazine's chief foreign correspondent. We have a link to his cover story from the June 30th issue of Time Magazine on our show page at WNYC.org. Also to the post that he just mentioned. And Michael, thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, my great pleasure. Thanks for giving me so much time to talk.
We'll be right back.